George Washington was the first, you see. He once chopped down a cherry tree.
President number two would be John Adams. And then number three,
Tom Jefferson stayed up to write the Constitution late at night. So he and his wife had a great big fight, and she made him sleep on the couch all night.
Happy belated President's Day to you. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, February the 22nd. It's also Fat Tuesday. Financial planner Kevin McKinley has his beads on. Not really. And he has all sorts of Mardi Gras advice on your dollars and cents, and including the future of dollar bills and coins. Plus, he is ready to answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And we have a special treat. He joins us this morning in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Madison. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
It's good to see you face to face. It doesn't happen very often.
No, I enjoy it as well. It's nice to get back home here. I'm wondering on that song that Rob played on the opening here, do they update that song for every new president every 4 to 8 years or so?
I don't know if we kept it going, how far down the line they would have went there.
Let's not find out.
Yeah, let's not. Rob picks some very interesting music.
Yes, he does. He's very good at that.
Hey, happy Fat Tuesday, too. I have with me some Mardi Gras coins. These are, I don't know what they are, but they're for you.
So. They're legal tender, I believe, down on the bayou.
Speaking of coins, even though it's not President's Day, yesterday was President's Day, there is a lot of talk about the rising costs of making dollar coins, making dollar bills. Might we be losing one way of honoring our presidents?
Did you even know that there was a presidential coin honoring 45 presidents in existence?
Maybe not. I knew there was a dollar coin, but it's specifically for a presidential coin.
Well, there's a dollar coin that Sacagawea,
who has
the little kid in the backpack. But this one is the 45 presidents. They've made about a billion of these coins, and nobody likes them, and nobody even knows about them. So they're stopping production on them, which is going to save about $50 million by not producing these things. And they're actually sitting in a warehouse right now, completely unused. Nobody knows really what to do with them. But a bigger issue is the cost of other coins that we are using. The penny right now costs about 2.4 cents to produce, and the nickel costs about 11.2 cents to produce as well. And it doesn't take a math major to figure out that we're losing money by producing these things. Now, the penny has more zinc than copper. The nickel has more copper than nickel. There's no silver in either one of them, but just the rising costs that a lot of us have felt have also translated to higher raw material costs. And even the cost of printing dollars has gone up because there's a lot of cotton in it. The price of cotton has gone up quite a bit. It typically costs now about 10 cents to make a dollar bill. And because of a recent rise in the price of cotton, it's going to cost Americans an extra $200 million to print up all of these. And these little nickels and dimes can really add up in price, but they make 8.2 billion coins every single year. About 60% of those are pennies, 12% are nickels. And when we're trying to cut costs, every single turn, those costs add up. So there's been several different ideas on how we can reduce those expenses.
That's interesting. The cost of making money. Are there any ways to reduce these costs?
Well, President Obama has already addressed the issue in a little known and less discussed provision of his last proposal. His solution is to use an aluminum alloy to make pennies and nickels, and that could save about $100 million per year in cost. But there's big political opposition to this. A lot of it is from politicians who represent states that have a lot of zinc mining. And there's even, of course, a K Street lobbyist group called Americans for Common Sense, and that's with C-E-N-T-S. And they are ostensibly numismatically advocates, but they are backed up by the zinc mining industry. Public really likes coins, and they're worried one of the solutions is said, you know, why don't we just do away with the penny, and then we can, everything will be in 5 cent increments. Well, they know, of course, where their prices are going to go. It's always going to be rounded up. People really like coins, except dollar coins. As we mentioned, a bunch of the presidential ones are sitting there. Very few people have ever even seen the current dollar coin, the Sacagawea one, and about 70% of Americans say that they are against getting rid of the paper dollar and going to a dollar coin, even though the dollar coins last about 20 times longer and only cost about twice as much to produce as a dollar bill.
Yeah, I know that I've talked to a guest who said that it would be so much cheaper if we did the dollar coin, but I'm almost embarrassed to use the dollar coin when I get one rarely in a transaction.
Depending on the sophistication of the clerk with whom you're dealing, you may be accused of being a counterfeiter trying to, you know, put a $2 bill across them as well.
Well, so are things going to change then in how we pay for things?
Well, they already have, obviously. Interestingly, we still pay for more things recently with debit cards and plastic than we do with cash, but in the last economic crunch, cash became actually a more widely used form of currency than plastic. If people didn't have it or they didn't want to spend plastic that they're living close to the edge with. You're seeing a lot more with prepaid cards, both with benefits and everything. Currency still, though, offers safety, anonymity, and sentimental value, so I don't think that's going away anytime soon.
So any suggestions what we should do with all the spare change that we accumulate over time?
Coinstar, the company that accumulates change, you can dump your change in, say, at the grocery store, and you get coupons back or credits for merchandise. They say we've got about $10 billion with a B dollars sitting in jars and behind the sofa cushions. And that actually kind of makes sense because I think most people have about $50 to $60 or so sitting around in change. And if there are 110 to 120 million households in America, that adds up to about $10 billion or so. It's probably not money that you're going to miss. If you do take it into the bank, sometimes they're even going to charge you to actually count it and credit you for it. And again, you can take it to a Coinstar facility that's in a lot of these supermarkets. But I'd rather have you look at it as maybe a fun expense. It's not money that you sit there saying, okay, gosh, if I spend $80 on this, that's a lot of money. But if it's sitting in the change jar, it's technically out of mind and out of sight, so it's nice to use for that. Some people I know take it to the bank with their kids and have the kids guess the amount, and who's ever closest, you know, gets a dollar or gets $2 or something. That's neat because it inspires a lifelong lust for gambling in young children. That can be very helpful for them. And another thing that I do know that people do, they've told me, is they say that I save up all my change. When it's our membership drive here in Wisconsin Public Radio, they take it to the bank, and that's the amount that they contribute.
I like that. I like that very much. I was going to say I have a jar of pennies and quarters and nickels and dimes, and my husband and I both contribute to it. And the last time we brought it into the credit union, 200 and some bucks.
It's an amazing amount of money. No one ever says, oh, I thought it was going to be more. It's always like you bring in this jar and it's $88 or something.
And I thought I was going to bring it to Las Vegas when I go there in a couple of weeks, but I think the contribution to public radio is a better idea.
And you probably wouldn't get through the metal detector with all that change in your pockets.
Right. That'd be kind of hard. All right. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Kevin, we received an email from John who says, I always enjoy your segment on WPR. Regrettably, my wife and I are divorcing. If I let her keep her retirement, I will keep the house and her equity. I would refinance and be able to afford the payments. I will be 51 this year, so I have a long time to work before retirement. Thanks for any help. Oh, that's a tough situation.
It is. And John, thank you for leading off with the false praise of the show, saying you always enjoy my segment on WPR. I don't even always enjoy my segment, so I can't believe you do as well. No, I'm sorry to hear that, but no good marriage has ever ended in divorce, so I'm glad that he and his wife are moving on. And this can be an expensive proposition. As we mentioned a few weeks ago, the average cost of a divorce runs about $18,000 or so. But I like the philosophy that he and his wife are adopting. Many times if a couple are splitting up and the house has to be sold, both lose, because not only do they have to sell it in a hurry, but they also have to pay commission costs to sell it. And then if they do decide to buy a home on their own, they're going to have to pay commission costs as well to do that. They're already going through a lot of disruption already, so hopefully they can use this division to make the best of a bad situation.
So how do separating couples normally deal with a house?
Well, they actually often make a mistake. Typically, one person has a strong emotional attachment to keeping the house, but they don't have enough income to maintain it on their own. Or worse, they get the ownership of the house and they get some cash and they're deathly afraid of having a mortgage payment. So they use all the cash they get in the separation to pay the mortgage off, and they could end up very quickly house rich and cash poor. And the first time some kind of financial emergency comes up, they have to sell the house at a bad price, and they end up really behind the eight ball, even more so than a divorce can already cause people to be.
So what do you advise John to do to balance his mortgage payments and saving for retirement?
Well, I think the standard advice applies. I think you should get the 30-year mortgage for as much as the lender will allow. That's typically about 80% of the loan to value. He should also open up a home equity line of credit if the lender will allow, so that he can also tap that if there's some other financial emergency. If he has an at-work retirement savings plan, he should first definitely get the employer match. Second of all, he should try to get himself down to the 15% federal tax bracket. For a single filer who's working, that's not too difficult to get up and over that 15% ceiling, because it's about $35,000 for 2012, which usually works out to about $45,000 of gross income. And finally, if he wants to keep his savings set aside but still save for retirement and have it be accessible when he needs it, he should use the Roth IRA, because he can pull the contributions back out whenever he wants, at any time, for any reason, with no taxes or penalties whatsoever.
Thank you, John, for the email, and good luck to you. If you have an email, a question for Kevin, you can send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can call 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, and you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Time now to take your personal finance questions for Kevin. Full lines right now, but you can get in after someone hangs up, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We start with Daniel in Milwaukee. Hello, Daniel.
Good morning, Joy and Kevin. Kevin, I have a question about a Roth IRA. I'm recently found myself in between two jobs, and I'll be starting a new job in the middle of March. I definitely am thinking about opening a Roth IRA, but I'm a little confused of some of the basics, like who actually offers them, are there different kinds of Roth IRAs? And then I don't know if you can help me with my next question, being the company I'm leaving is a pretty strong company. Is it ever beneficial just to leave your 401 in there? Because we're able to still contribute, I found out, like monthly. So I don't know if that question makes real good sense.
They're letting you contribute to the plan even if you're not in it anymore?
The stock plan part of it. Not the 401.
Okay. I would be more interested in having you take control of that account at the other employer, just because it's easier to keep an eye on it. You get more selection from it. And wherever you choose to open the Roth IRA, Daniel, that's also where you can move that retirement plan to as well. And purchasing company stock, it's a nice idea, but typically on paper it works, and in real life it doesn't work very well, in part because of all the bookkeeping hassles and tracking it down. So what I'd rather have you do is open a Roth IRA, and you can do that at any mutual fund provider like Vanguard or Fidelity or Charles Schwab or TD Ameritrade. You could also open it up at banks, credit unions, investment companies, brokerage firms, insurance companies. All these places will gladly help you open a Roth IRA. And then when you do, you can say, oh, by the way, I've got this other plan and I want to roll that over into it. And keep in mind, Daniel, that the Roth IRA is really just like a jar in which you can put just about any different kind of paper investment you want, whether it's a stock or a certificate of deposit or a mutual fund.
Okay, Daniel.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. Good luck to you. Charlie in Fitchburg is with us. Hello, Charlie.
Hi. I'm interested in I-bonds. There was a phone number available to get answers to questions. I called and waited on the line for each of these two calls for an hour with without anyone responding. So I have questions of you. To get paper I-bonds, one has to work through the Internal Revenue Service on the tax returns. And can you tell me, if one doesn't have a return, can one still buy an I-bond?
Hold on, Charlie. We'll get back to you on that one.
Yeah, I'm going to put you on hold here for about an hour.
Kidding.
Just kidding, Charlie. Yeah, that's it. These I-bonds are a great investment. They're Series I savings bonds you purchase through the Treasury. They're wonderful investments. They currently pay about 3.06% interest, and that interest rate is adjusted every 6 months. The bad news is you cannot buy them in person at banks and credit unions like you once could. You have to go online at treasurydirect.gov.gov, open an account. It's a bit of a pain, but once you get into it and figure out how to navigate it, then you can continue to not only maintain those bonds but purchase more every single year. You can only buy $10,000 per person per year of these Series I savings bonds, but you can also use your tax refund to purchase up to $5,000 more of the bonds. And again, that's a little bit complicated. You have to fill out a special form to do so. But yes, you can purchase $10,000, but you have to do it online. You have to have an email account, you have to have web access and everything, and they're trying to make these things actually a little bit more difficult to purchase because they're such a good investment. But don't let that keep you from doing so, Charlie.
But I can get the paper even though I don't, if I did not have a big refund. If I had a $7 refund, I could buy a $5,000 I-bond through the IRS, through an IRS form, you're saying.
No, you have to use your, it can only be for the amount of your refund, no more, no less. I'm betting, Charlie, that some shrewd people are actually going to be withholding, having more withheld from their taxes so that they can then use the proceeds to buy a Series I savings bonds. I'm not recommending that, but I'm betting some people will do that.
And how can I get someone to advise me so I don't make a mistake in dealing with the internet system and buy the wrong thing? Or
it's not too bad. If you can, you know, dial the phone to get through, and you can sit on the phone with the IRS for an hour waiting for some help or the Treasury, you should be able to do it as well. You do need online access, though, to be able to get it. Maybe someone, you know, I don't know if someone at the library sometimes can walk you through just opening the account or so, but then again, you are using that on a public computer, so watch out.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. I hope that helps. Good luck to you. Jim in Appleton is our next caller. Hello, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I enjoy your program, and I've even contributed during Kevin's segment, and I am a little bit of a coin collector myself, although not much of one. Maybe by the time my grandkids are adults, it might be worth something. But here's my question. It's a little bit, the answer may be easy, but the situation is complicated. I am going to be 66. My wife is already, or soon to be 66 also. We are divorced, and I have done extensive internet research on, you know, switching over everybody's Social Security and so on. However, I am still working and intend to work, and I've been looking for a calculator to determine whether I would be better off in the long run collecting my full retirement Social Security at 66 or wait a couple of years out to get the 8% addition. And the deal is I have access to a company, Roth 401k, which I've actually been contributing about $18,000 a year into now. But I figured I could throw some more into that.
Hold on,
and
Jim.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, do you have some thoughts on this?
Yes, I do. First of all, Jim, the calculator you're looking for is not online. It's at your doctor's office because the break-even age for your life expectancy is typically about 78 to 79. So if your doctor says, yeah, you're going to live a really long time, it's probably best to wait and collect that. And you are right that the longer you wait, for every year you wait to initiate your Social Security payments, the dollar amount you're getting per month goes up 8%. However, what they don't tell you in those calculators is that for every year you wait to collect, you are now 1 year closer to death. And that helps compensate for that extra dollar bump up that you're getting. I'm more interested in a couple things. First of all, for most people, I prefer that they actually take Social Security early. Typically, most people don't have enough money to just simply live off their assets when they retire. Second of all, are you going to be in the 25% tax bracket this year, Jim, would you think?
Well, I'm not. I guess I make about $65,000. So
okay.
And standard deductions and a mortgage and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. My preference would be actually that you use a regular 401k rather than a Roth 401k, and then use the Roth IRA for any extra savings you have, because you'll save yourself about 20 cents in taxes for every dollar you get into that 401k. And the Roth doesn't provide a lot of benefit in that way. You do get to make a bigger contribution to it, but I think you're probably going to be in a fairly low tax bracket once you do retire, and therefore the tax-free benefit of the Roth 401k will not have as big advantage to you at that time. And second of all, I would probably not have you take the Social Security, just because when you pile that on top of your current income, it's going to be taxed pretty heavily. And in your case, if you got enough to get by, I'd probably have you wait. Now, if you were to say, no, I'm retiring today and I don't know what to do, then I would say definitely take Social Security, get that money in your hand and do with it what you wish, and then you can keep whatever you have saved up intact for later on.
Well, I'm trying to even up my Roth with my regular 401k to make those about even so they're tax neutral.
Okay, that's not a bad idea. But you said you're using a regular 401k or a Roth 401k?
I am right now, but I've got a regular 401k that's outside of my employment, but I'm loading up my Roth inside my employment, trying to level those out.
Okay, yeah, it's not a bad idea. If all of the things being equal, I'd rather have you get the tax break on the pre-tax contributions to the 401k. But yeah, otherwise I'd delay taking Social Security.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. Good luck to you. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up in a little bit later in the program, we'll talk about leasing a car. Is it a good idea or not? Or when is it a good idea or not? That's coming up later during On Your Money. Mike in Dodgeville is our next caller. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Yes, I have a tax-related question also. The question I have is, can charitable donations be made to governmental organizations like they are to other charities like Goodwill and so on? And is that contribution deductible like it would be to Goodwill?
Which government organizations of which do you speak?
I have a relative that is in a county-operated nursing home, and I've thought that a material donation to that nursing home would be a really nice thing to do. And that's the question I have. Is that tax deductible?
Probably not, unless it's a qualified nonprofit, unless they have a separate entity set up, like a foundation where they are set up so that they've got the mechanism in place to not only give you the tax break on it, but also to handle the money as well, because it's not just a case of, well, here's a few $1,000, do with it what you wish. You probably want some responsible management on that. But I check with the organization, they should be very well versed on whether or not the money that you donate is tax deductible. Again, you probably have to organize or itemize rather to be able to take advantage of that deduction as well.
Okay, so they're going to be the ones that will tell me whether they're able to do it.
Yep, and you can also check them, check the organization up. CharityNavigator.org, I think, is a site that you can look at to see if they are a qualified nonprofit. And sometimes organizations will say they are, and they might not be, or they might not be on the up and up. So Charity Navigator, and again, we'll have that link up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right. Thanks very much, Mike, for the call. We'll get to more of your calls in just a few minutes. Time now for Smart Assets. Last week, Kevin, we talked about how couples comprised of one spender and one saver could try to avoid money arguments. This week, we're going to cover what you should do if you and your loved one have different investment philosophies.
Yeah, and it's very common. We are typically attracted to our financial and emotional opposites, and much like spending and saving, someone who is confident might be overly aggressive might be attracted to someone who has more of a conservative nature and is more reliable, more solid. And hopefully the couple together is stronger together with these complementary attributes, if you will, than they would be if they were apart and on their own. But sometimes, again, it can lead to a lot of conflict if they can't find a way to agree with each other.
Yeah. Well, so I am. I take more risk in my investments, and my husband is more conservative in his investments. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, then. And it's difficult sometimes because you're attracted to these people. For most people, when they start out together, they generally have little or no money, so there's nothing to discuss or disagree upon. And so, as they get older, the money hopefully starts to accumulate, and you become on the cusp of retirement, and all of a sudden it becomes almost like driving, where you have one person who says, you know, I can go 10 miles over the speed limit and I don't need to buckle up, and the other member of the couple sitting in the passenger seat grabbing on to the, you know, just pressing an imaginary brake on the floor. It's the same thing with investing.
So what is the first step to finding a compromise or an agreeable investment strategy?
You need to find out who is right.
I am.
You are.
Yeah. That's easy.
Let your husband
now
know.
What?
Well, that was easy. That was very easy. Everyone listening to the show, in a couple, you are correct. The other person is wrong. You have
no,
my blessings
seriously,
on
folks.
That. Yeah. You need to find out if you really do need to have a very aggressive strategy, or if you can get by on a very conservative one that doesn't have a lot of volatility but won't have a lot of gain. What you should do is add up your projected spending over what you're going to need, both working and in retirement. Calculate your life expectancy into how much longer you're going to need that money, and then toy around with some variable rates of return. And you can use the calculators online. There's one at dinkytown.net that we'll have up at onyourmoney.com later on today. And if you find that you can get by on 2 or 3%, then you can afford to be more conservative. And if you say, you know what, we need 6 or 8% a year over the next 30 years to hit our goals, we're going to have a few white knuckle quarters as we try to get that higher rate of return.
I love that name, dinkytown.net.
Yeah, it's actually a guy up in the Twin Cities, and people are familiar with the campus area of the University of Minnesota. It's known as Dinkytown, and that's why he calls it Dinkytown.
You know that. So, all right. So, what if that strategy doesn't work?
Well, then it's time to split the assets up. Not so much in name, where you have to retitle everything, but in allocation. Maybe you go 50% each. Say, okay, you kind of manage this money the way you want it to be managed, and I'll manage it the way I want it to be managed. Or just say this is a basic amount. We figured out we have, you know, we can, if we have $400,000, let's say, and we need $300,000 to make sure that it's there when we retire, then you can have the other amount left over for the person to be more aggressive with. Or one spouse can get authorization to manage the other one's account, and vice versa. And then you can even rebalance. I have some couples where I've seen where the conservative one and the aggressive one each manage kind of half of the money, and then when the money grows too far in one direction or the other, they wisely put it over into the other person's pot so they can be 50-50 again.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I have to admit that my husband and I are, he's closer to retirement than I am, so mm-hmm. It makes sense to have slightly different strategies.
That's right.
There. Yeah. So, what if one of the members of the couple is a trader?
Well, you see this in not so much in terms of, you know, aggressively buying and selling stocks every single day, but likes to own stocks, is interested, follows the market, or someone who says, hey, I want to invest in a business. I want to go into my brother-in-law with a, you know, a restaurant or something. Then you separate that amount of money and say, here, let's agree upon amount of money that you can put into either this venture or something that's more aggressive that we're not comfortable with. And once you get this amount of money, you can do with it whatever you wish. But after it's gone, it's gone. You don't get any more to feed against it, because if you can turn it into something that's really profitable, then great. You get even more to deal with. But if you can't, it doesn't jeopardize our financial security, and it doesn't make the more conservative investor more nervous.
Okay, sounds good. Time now for more calls for Kevin. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Chris in Madison is with us next. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Joy. I have a question. I'm 51, and I have to rebuild my house, and the property is worth more than the house, and the house to fix it up would cost more than to tear it down. But my return, when I calculate my income taxes, I have $6,000 coming back. I have to have a down payment for this new house. Should I still put this money in an IRA, or should I keep it in cash?
So you're going to, you plan on spending this, Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah.
in about 6 months.
Yeah, my preference is that you just put it in your checking account and not use the IRA or the Roth IRA, partially because it's such a pain to get it in and then get it back out again, but also because I don't want you to put it into something that, you know, a butterfly in grease flaps his wings and you lose 10% of the value in a matter of months. And so I'd just as soon have you keep it safe. You're going to be going through enough turmoil with this rebuilding project. You don't need to be worrying about the balance of the money that is, quite frankly, really crucial to making sure this gets done. So I'd just soon have you put it in the checking account and forget about it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you, Chris. Yep. Here's an email from Richard in South Range. Something must be wrong with the alignment of the universe because for the very first time, I disagree with Kevin.
What?
Uh-oh. The people I give presidential dollar coins to are ecstatic. The barber, a cab driver, a waiter at the restaurant, they love receiving them. The newest coins are released 4 times a year, and I'm always getting excited to get the latest. I just purchased a roll of $25 yesterday. So,
well, good for you. You've got about a billion more to get all the way through before you're finally through all those coins. But no, I'm a reformed coin nerd too, so I like the idea, and I think it does make great sense from an intrinsic value and from common sense and cost perspective. But they're trying to carry around $20 worth of $1 coins. I think it's a neat thing, especially neat for to give to grandkids. For, you know, it seems a lot more interesting than, say, you know, a check, or especially because the checks I used to get from my grandparents, they'd bounce a lot, which, you know, it was nice, but I had to start asking for ID, and it was a mess. But yeah, it's a neat idea. I don't think in the day-to-day life that we have of spending money, I don't think it's probably going to be widely accepted.
Thank you, Richard. And I think I'm the one who said that I was hesitant to be using them in public so much. But anyway, we take your questions about dollar coins or dollar bills or any money matter, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And baby, I love you.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and it's time to talk about leasing a car. Leasing a car is often seen as a waste of money and a chance to get taken for a ride at the dealership. And Kevin, I have to admit, it doesn't look very attractive to me.
It just goes against our Midwestern agrarian sensibilities to borrow something for a while. You just use it and you don't own it at the end of it. It's all the things, you know, and the, if you were raised on a farm or you were raised by people who were raised by people who were raised on a farm, there's something about leasing that just doesn't seem to make sense, and it seems to be almost the opposite of good financial strategy.
But for some, it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking kind of a maybe a younger person out of high school or college who needs very reliable transportation, doesn't have a ton of money set aside either for a down payment for a car or to pay for repairs, and can't afford to miss work or get a new car if something should go wrong with the vehicle. So they have a good credit rating, they need something that's very reliable, and they might be trading a vehicle in a few years because of life change. Someone says, you know, we just got married, we might have kids in a few years, we'll need a different vehicle. It's a very good time to look at leasing a car for those kinds of people.
But what about once you're done giving all that money for all those months, you don't have a car?
Well, it's true, but that's not necessarily a disadvantage. Most leases have what's known as a residual value written in. That's the difference between the price that the car costs and then what the value will be at the end of the lease. And the nice thing about that is you can either buy the vehicle at that price, or you can reject it. So if car prices drop a lot, you say, you know what, no offense, I'm going to give you the car back because I can buy a similar vehicle for a much lower price than the residual value. Or you say, wow, car prices haven't dropped very much. This is a really good deal. You have the right to buy it as long as it's in there. So you put a lot of the risk of car prices fluctuating on the backs of the seller, and you can use it to work in your favor a few months down the road, or a few years down the road for that matter.
So let's say somebody is considering leasing a car. What should we keep in mind?
Well, just because you're not putting any money down for it, don't go overboard on the vehicle. You should still get one that's practical and sensible and well within your budget. You still need very good credit to get the best terms on the lease. Sometimes you can see there's new car promotions for leasing if the dealer or the manufacturer are trying to promote it. And you can also lease a used car. You know, you don't have to just go out and buy a brand new car. You can lease a used car as well. Watch out for the mileage restrictions, though, because typically they say, all right, this lease is if you put on 12,000 miles a year for 3 years, and anything over that, you pay 15 to 20 cents. More than that, a lot of people get frightened by that. But, you know, if you buy a car and you put X amount of miles on it, that still makes the car depreciate at least as much as well, too. So it's not that big of a deal. But if you think you're going to be driving a lot, you might want to look at some other mileage levels above and beyond what the standard 12 to 15,000 miles are.
So once you find that car of your dreams, are you able to negotiate the best leasing terms?
Yeah, don't start with saying, I want to lease a vehicle when you walk into the dealership. Start shopping for the car first. Find one that is right for you and has a price that's very good. Once you negotiate the price down to the best one you can get, that's when you start discussing the leasing terms. When you get the contract, definitely look at the residual value. Make sure it's in there. And also look at the interest rate on it. Don't take the salesperson's word for it. Actually ask to see it documented in the contract, because you are paying interest on money, but it's only on the difference between what you're paying for the car now and what the residual value is, rather than the amount, whole amount of the car. And also keep in mind, you are going to have to come up with a little bit of a down payment typically. But for most people who are good candidates to be leasing a vehicle, the lower the down payment is typically better, so you can keep more cash on hand.
Anything else? Any other issues we should consider?
The payment isn't the final cost of the car. Even if you say, well, this is going to be a lease for, say, $279 a month, you're also going to pay taxes and fees on it, and also make sure that there is gap insurance, which is usually included in the coverage, but that's the difference that the insurance company wants if your vehicle gets totaled between what the vehicle is worth and what they're actually going to pay for it. And also keep in mind, you are not going to have very much maintenance, because you're probably going to only have the new vehicle while it's still under warranty, but you still do have to make oil changes and some of the basics as well.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Now time for many more phone calls. Steve in Madison is with us. Hello, Steve.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about my son's situation. He works for the government overseas. And he's trying to save money. He's not in the military. He works at the Foreign Service. So he's got free room and board, and he wants to buy a condo when he comes back to D.C. in maybe 4 years. So he wants to have access to the money but try to get some kind of a return. Is there any place, mutual fund or something, to put it in?
Boy, anything, 4 years typically, when you start talking years, it typically sounds like a long-term investment, but I would prefer he keep things, maybe, go 50-50 between CDs. Those Series I savings bonds that we mentioned a little bit ago are also a good way to go, and then maybe half of that in some kind of total stock market index fund, but understand that it wouldn't shock me at all to have that the stock market index fund be worth 20% less at some point between now and the 4 years. So if he's not comfortable with that, he should probably just stick to the CDs and the savings bonds.
Yeah, he wants to get some kind of return, but how risky? I guess that's up to him on how risky he wants to be. Right?
Yeah, no matter the time frame we have and what our goals are for that money, Steve, that's the pressing question. Now, how do I get return without risk? And there really are very few things out there that offer any kind of rate of return, much less the 5 to 10% that we've become accustomed to over the last 20 or 30 years without putting in a lot of risk as well.
Steve, thanks for the call. Best wishes to your son. Philip in Madison is with us. Hello, Philip.
Thanks for taking my call. If I am working and if my spouse is not working and if we both are above 55, and I understand that the maximum contribution for Roth IRA is $6,000, can you contribute to a Roth IRA for your non-working spouse?
Yeah, by non-working, Philip, you don't mean she's lazy or anything, right?
No.
No. Okay, good. She just doesn't work in a job that pays money, correct?
Right.
Okay. Yes, absolutely you can, as long as you qualify for a Roth. There are income limitations for who can contribute to a Roth and who can't. And typically, for married couples filing jointly, I think it's like $170,000 or something of adjusted gross income. But yes, you can put in, let's say you make $12,000 in a year. You can put in $6,000 for a Roth for yourself and $6,000 for your spouse as well, if he or she's over 50, as long, even if he or she does not have any earned income. And if you're under 50, it's $5,000 per person.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you, Philip. And Pat in Mequon is next. Hello, Pat.
Hi. I purchased a house and with another person, with a partner, and she became disabled and had to move out to California to be with her family. So I bought out her share, and now I am refinancing. What people are telling me, and I've talked to several different people, is they're offering like a 7-year arm or a 10-year arm, because right now I need cash. I need to get more cash out of this situation. So what does doing an arm like that, how does that compare to the 30-year fixed?
Well, actually, I don't think it. If you need cash, both of the longtime listeners of this show will know what I'm going to say. But you're better off going with a 30-year mortgage, Pat. Even if you say, "Oh gosh, I'll be X amount of years old when that 30 years is done," that's not a concern of yours right now. Your concern is keeping as much cash as possible on hand. Now, the lender might say, "Look, the only way we can give you a mortgage, if you're in more dire circumstances, is an ARM." And if that's the case, then that's what you have to go with. But otherwise, I would much rather have you go with a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. I'm guessing the payments are going to be almost as low, if not lower, than what the 7- to 10-year ARM is. And best of all, the interest rates are going to be very close to that. And then you're fixed, and you know exactly what the payment's going to be for the next 360 months, and you don't have to worry about it as long as you have some kind of check coming in, whether it's Social Security or a pension check.
Well, I'm already retired, and next year my income will double. And I think that's why they're trying to get me to do the ARM, because I don't know how long I can hold this property by myself.
Mm-hmm. A 30-year mortgage still gives you more flexibility and certainty.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. Good luck, Pat.
All right. Good luck. I was going to ask her income's going to double in retirement next year. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful job. You're curious now what she did for a living.
Yeah, thank you, Pat. You know, I'm going to briefly ask you, Kevin, a financial advisor that my husband talked to. He is close to retirement, and this financial advisor said, you know what, you only got 4 years left on your mortgage. Mm-hmm. You pay it off early. Pay it off, and instead of refinancing for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage and doing what you tell me that we should do.
Right.
Yeah, what is that thing about, you know, about pay it off or
it's
or
conventional wisdom, and typically it's probably the right thing to do, as long as nothing bad and you never happens for the next 30 years and you never have any negative surprises. And if for some people they say, you know what, it just feels good to have it paid off, then pay it off. But for other people, say, well, wait a minute, I'm entering in a new phase in my life where my income's probably going to stop. I have savings, but it's a limited amount. It's very difficult to get money out of this equity of your home, and many of us have a great deal of our net worth tied up in the equity of our home. It's very difficult to tap that, especially when you or the economy or both are in very dire circumstances. So I'd rather have you get that money up front now. A lot of people we talked about who have diligently paid down their mortgages also have avoided making improvements to their home. Well, I'd rather have someone take that money out, spend it on something you can enjoy by making improvements to the home. It does lend to the value as well. And then you get enjoyment from that money rather than having this just, you know, paid for albatross that you just sit and, you know, basically wait to die in. If you say I'm going to have to pull payments out of my IRA and it's going to put me in a higher tax bracket, I'd watch out for that. If it keeps you up at night, don't take out the mortgage. But still, I feel like for most people, it's more conservative to actually have the mortgage and the money from the mortgage than it is to have no mortgage but no money from the mortgage.
Have you been to my house? the albatross. Jeff in Antioch, Illinois is next. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. I've got a question. I'm a self-employed contractor, have been for 30-ish years. And, you know, mostly I live from, job to job. It's it's real tough to put away money. Any ideas? Any help?
Yeah, are you, well, let me ask you this. Are you a homeowner?
I am.
Okay, and you still have a mortgage and a mortgage payment?
No, actually, I built a house for myself, by myself, no mortgage, no nothing.
Wonderful. Okay, so that right there is a pretty decent store of wealth for you, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and you don't want to pass that on to anybody? It's yours to do with it what you wish?
Well, you know, when I'm dead and gone, my kids can have it.
Okay, well, are they going to move into it, or are they probably just going to sell it?
I have no idea. And probably just sell it.
Okay, and Jeff, would your kids say to you, Dad, whatever you do, don't sell or use the money from that house. We want you to die, and then we get the money. Or would they say, Dad, we want you to enjoy that money?
No, they'd say, do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a nice goal to have it be there for them, but I wouldn't have it be the primary goal.
Now, that's right.
Now, second of all, Jeff, are you also, when you have been working, have you been contributing to Social Security as the law requires?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, it's one thing that happened. How old are you?
57.
Okay. Here's the thing about people who struggle from paycheck to paycheck, and there are millions and millions of people like you out there, Jeff. There are way more people who are wondering, you know, how am I going to get through the month than there are saying, oh, gosh, you know, what am I going to do with this extra $1 million that I made last year? You get a paid-for home. You get a check from Social Security. And maybe, you know, you pick up some spare work here and there. I'm guessing you're still able to do work when it's there, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. All of a sudden, that Social Security check can make a really big difference in your life because you pile that on top of your income, and it's like an extra bonus. We talked about the woman from the call a couple times ago of saying, you know, my income's going to double. Well, you know, if you make it to 62, your income is going to double. And I wouldn't recommend you do this as a first step, but as a backstop, it's a great place to look at a reverse mortgage on that home, meaning that you can go to the bank, and let's say the home is worth $200,000. They will give you $130,000, $140,000 right there. You don't have to pay it back. You don't have to sell the house or anything. And so you do have more net worth than what it feels like, Jeff. I would try to set money aside, but don't feel like, you know, you're going to be redoing kitchens in your late 80s.
Wow, that's sort of where I thought I would be.
Okay, well, if you are doing it, you'll be doing it because you want to, hopefully not because you have to.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Jeff, for calling. Much luck. One last call from Dan in Schulzburg. Hello, Dan.
Yes, this is my question. Well, this is my circumstances. I'm 26. Right now I'm working part-time. I spent part of the year last year finishing up college, and probably about a third to half the year I was pretty much unemployed, and right now I'm only working part-time. But the issue is I want to set something aside for the future, for retirement, because, you know, I'm 26, time flies.
Yep.
Yeah, Dan, because we have only a minute.
Speaking of time flying, Dan, Roth IRA, definitely the Roth IRA. You're not making much money, so you're not in a very big tax bracket, so the tax deduction of a normal IRA doesn't help you out. The cool thing about the Roth IRA is you can pull the contributions to that back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties. So if you do run into a rough spot, the money's there for you when you need it. And if you don't need it in retirement, it's tax-free.
Thank you, Dan, for calling. Time for the website of the week, Kevin.
TrueCar.com. TrueCar.com gives you an idea of what a particular make and model goes for in your area and will even help you haggle with local dealers to get the best price possible. TrueCar.com. We'll have a link up to that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Well, good. Sounds good. I hope you can stay and have a piece of king cake after the show.
That's why I came to Madison.
There we go. It's Fat Tuesday, and I picked up a king cake at the grocery store, and we're going to see who gets the little baby figurine. Whoever gets that is king for a day. And or you get good fortune. I'm not sure. One of those things.
The mind reels.
Anyway, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And we will be back next week at this time with another edition of On Your Money. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, we will talk with the author of the book Quiet, The Power of Introverts. That's tomorrow between 8 and 9. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Rob Ferret for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.